subtly eyed each other across the gravel parking space. It was 7 a.m., and I'd slid out at 5 a.m., which was when the tiny town's cafe opened, so I could take advantage of my hostel discount and try to muster confidence about all the climbs ahead of me that day. The wiry man continued to lean at an angle off the side of the massive truck. He'd already overhanded a number of packs snugly into the roof bars, but this one had clearly piqued his interest. "There's a damn axe in here. Seriously. Come on, you guys. Who brought the hatchet? This pack must weigh upwards of 70 pounds. He scanned the small crowd and looked disappointed, as though we'd already let him down with this egregious error, the too heavy pack. This man, this stranger who had already through-hiked and whom we could only look up to in awe. No one answered the call, and he dropped the bag with a disdainful thunk to the dusty ground. There it sat for a moment, all dark green fabric and straps, looking ashamed at being so full. "Sorry I was late," I mumbled. "That one's mine." I pointed to my brand new Gossamer Gear pack, chosen after sleepless days and nights combing the internet from my perspective of utterly clueless hiker in my months of AT prep in the UK. He hefted it up. "Pretty good," he said, running his eyes briefly over my shiny everything, as I tried to look like it was all just new gear by accident, and not because I'd never really used any of it before. "Sweet," I said, beaming internally, but keeping the straight face of an old hand. At that moment, a tall young man loped onto the scene. I remember his name was Lee. He tipped his head back in the morning light and scanned the bags on the roof rack, then looked towards the pack left on the floor, the one in the dust, with the axe. We all looked at him, the hatchet man. We knew it must be his. "Dang, son, is that a hatchet in there?" Our heads all swiveled right as one. It was old man himself, out into the car park from his eponymous hostel. Short, powerful, and bearing all the hallmarks of a 60s deadhead, we were all a little intimidated by him and his brusque style. He was the start gun for our southbound hike and the welcoming committee for those finishing their northbound, the thrumming fuse holding both ends of a hiking circuit board that pulsed with hopes, sweat, and big characters. He didn't suffer fools or spare his words, which didn't bode well for Lee. "Every year, every time, someone comes with too much stuff and I have to tell him to get rid of it. No problem, though, young man. We can give you a shakedown for that bag right now, and you can tell us whether you want your extra gear shipped or given away." He paused to think and touched his short ponytail thoughtfully. "There'll be sobo hikers coming through here for a couple months now. It'll all get used." He leaned over and picked up the thick canvas army-style pack from the floor. It was the type of bag that looked ready for anything, except carrying it very far without swearing a lot. "No," said Lee, now still as a stone and clear as a bell. "No, I don't want to take anything out." We all looked at him, awed at his certainty. Old man paused and appraised Lee, tall, slim, and clearly very sure of his decision. "Okay, son. Well, that's on you." He tipped a nod at the bag swinger, who loaded it in. "Let's get you lot gone." With that, he was inside the van and started it up. We'd gone from being ready and ahead of the game with our packs in the lot to standing outside the loaded van that was revving to leave, from prepared and ready to playing catch-up in a heartbeat. This was to be the trail all over. We dove in. Part 2. Into the Woods. Maine. 281.4 miles.
I would just like to celebrate the fact that I have climbed four 4,000-foot peaks in the last 2 days, and I am feeling fucking great.
Chronic pain is under control. And I feel a bit more stupid.
only in terms of that my brain isn't thinking about all the million things it normally thinks about. It's just thinking about where I put my foot, where I put my foot, where am I going to camp, where can I get water?
Chapter 4. Are we hikers now? The ride into Baxter State Park took just under an hour. Old Man warmed up and used most of the ride to impart useful wisdom about near enough everything, including how much water we should carry. Not much, as the snow was melting and the rivers were high, and what we should do if we encountered a big, angry moose. I stared out of the window, trying to glimpse some majestic beasts, and marvelled that it was still over an hour until we even got to the ranger station, which would mark the beginning of the park. We were already in deep woodland, not moments into our journey. How vast could this place be? I felt suspended in the safety of the vehicle and the confidence of my fellow riders, as though I could count on them and they on me. As if our chatter on this morning had bonded us deeply and into a place of security. But I knew deep down that this was not true. The one couple in the car would have each other, but the rest of us were going to be turfed out of these last vestiges of real life and into the woods alone. The Appalachian Trail Hunger Games would begin, and we'd be fending for ourselves. I turned back to Old Man and listened as he continued to talk about how to save fuel when boiling water, while still making sure it killed any nasties inside. He wound up the latest hiking parable and went quiet, leaving the van silent and us all in a state of anticipation. What was coming? And then, as we started to turn a corner in the road, he slowed, fumbled with his CD player and asked us, "Are you ready?" "Yeah!" we all shouted, so excited and buoyed up with the anticipation, but with no idea what we were ready for. He pressed play and accelerated slightly. As we all leaned left around the corner, we caught our first breathtaking view of Mama Katahdin, and the car filled with the sound of Eye of the Tiger. She was vast, rising up from the forest and filling the windscreen. It seemed momentarily that my attempt at this trip was a joke, a gag and a ruse. I got that familiar wash of humiliation that I was going to be exposed as a sort of sporty fraud and told to sit back on the bench. No way was I going up there. Who, me? No, definitely not taking the risk. Time to spin the car around and back to the airport, please. But then shame and self-doubt were nudged aside by a different voice, one that I'd been working on making louder and louder these past months and years. I could do this. Yes, me. I was outdoorsy. I had beaten huge odds to get this far. I was going to do it, and if I was going to have to do it on my knees, I was still going to do it. And so I breathed the magnificent mountainous sight in and out, let a grin spread across my face, and turned to look at the others. Yes! The whole gang was grinning, and everyone feeling pumped to get up there. I went back to staring out of the window, singing along to the hiking hype music and giggling at Lee giving it his all in the back seat, fists pumping and head thrown back in song. I noticed a number of stickers on Old Man's water bottle, which was shoved in the centre console. One was a sketch of a hiker at the top of Katahdin with the words, "Save alcohol for later," underneath. Puzzling. But it wasn't until later that I realised people had been taking champagne and beer up to the summit to celebrate the end of their hikes, but some left smashed glass and trash up there before they descended. Totally shitty behaviour, and it made me wonder why some who say they love the outdoors seem to think it's okay to trash it. Deep into the woods we drove, the van slowing to crawl over potholes and down deep dents in the backcountry track. I thought I'd miss Kate, as she had decided not to summit Katahdin and instead to meet me back at the shelter that night. But I was glad to feel like a lone wolf again for a time. I kept trying to be in the through-hike mindset that I'd been working towards for so long, but then realised Kate needed me to be in the short-trip mindset too. Otherwise, how would I understand her totally valid fears and concerns and be supportive of her venturing entirely out of her element? It was hard, and I knew it was going to get harder. But for this moment, I was glad to have the space to sink back into my through-hike head and begin to feel like the lone adventurer I'd been hoping to be. Eventually, we pulled across a dirt parking area by Katahdin Stream Ranger Station and disgorged from the van. No sooner had I unfolded my body and stretched out on the dirt than I was attacked by flies and mosquitoes. They flew and tangled into my eyelashes, up my nose and onto my hands and neck. I spluttered a few out of my mouth and tried to yank my head net out of my bum bag, soon to be fanny pack, with one hand while swatting my face with the other. "Shit! Shit! Shit! These are ridiculous!" I exclaimed, pulling my net over my head, cap and all. "You ain't seen nothing yet," a man standing in the lot said, grinning. "They're thick like storm clouds in there." He was pointing at the woods. "Great, thanks." I smiled in a polite, "Whoo, that's rough, hey?" way, and turned to the rest of the van crew. They'd vanished. In the time I'd been fussing around, they'd been doing something more important, like listening to old man tell them what to do. I flailed around inside my headnet, trying to see where everyone had gone. I couldn't be falling behind on day one. But that in itself wasn't even a correct thought anymore. Falling behind who? I was on my own. But I wasn't on my own. Oh, heck, I would have to get used to this. Making friends with people, hiking with them, creating bonds, but having absolutely no guarantee that you'd ever see them again or that they'd wait for you anywhere. Not even knowing if you should wait for them. I didn't know the etiquette and clearly needed to get up to speed damn quickly. Tramping up the wooden steps, I followed the small group inside the ranger's office and noticed people's packs were already piled up in the porch area. I dumped mine on top and got the last spot in the line. Hiking Katahdin could take a person 9 hours to summit and descend, so everyone would have to stay the night here in the campground. Most people had already booked a pitch or cabin online months before, but many were sharing their large pitches with others. It was an unusually crowded time with the late thaw. It was the day after Katahdin officially opened, extremely delayed, and many hikers had been waiting with their cancelled entries from the week prior so that they could slide into any spots available. Of course, those with spots were very happy to oblige. That was the way it was with hikers, I was to learn, everyone wanting to help. Some hardy souls had suggested they might summit, descend, then carry on hiking on the trail to make a few extra miles that day. But Baxter didn't let people camp anywhere but Katahdin Spring on this route out. So if you wanted to leave this campground, you had to make damn sure that you hiked all the way out of the state park and made it to Abel Bridge, the next good, feasible spot to stop for a night. That was another 10-plus miles, though, so a hard nope for most after the exertion of climbing Mama Katahdin. As folks were forced to stay the night in Baxter, it didn't make sense to carry full packs up the mountain and back, so we swapped them for day packs at the cabin after we'd signed for our permits. I nodded a smile at the person before me as she picked up her bright yellow permit card and watched her step outside with a bounce of excitement. I think her name was Kelly, a curvy, laughing girl with joyful eyes. I knew immediately I liked her. My eyes glided across the wooden walls of the station, full of racks bulging with leaflets about the various trails and park initiatives that are run by these wonderful people. The ranger's voice pulled me from the moment, and I chatted happily with her, signing my form and singing cheery goodbyes over my shoulder as I hit the porch, then the dirt, double-checked I had my 2 water bottles, stove, snacks, and first aid in my day pack, and set off. Well, I kind of set off, because in my moment of bravado, I'd got entirely turned around and didn't know how to get out of the car park. For a moment, I pretended to tie my shoelace in order to watch Lee, who was dithering, decide where he was going to go so that I'd have a route to follow. Christ, I wondered if I was really cut out for this, questioning my skills as I watched Lee set out in a move that bemused me because it was very obviously the wrong way. I sat back on my heels to see how this would roll out. How could someone with an army-style pack and who carries a hatchet in their bag not know what they're doing in the great outdoors? Luckily, the ranger spotted him and came to her door, gently stopping him with a little shout and pointing out the right route. Thankful it hadn't been me, I waited a little longer to give Lee space, and then I started hiking. Over a wooden bridge, past my first wooden Appalachian Trail sign with arrows, places and distances written on it. It was as though my dream had stepped out from the screen of my computer. The countless research, reading and groups I'd dived into to get ready had become real. This very image that I'd seen before on other people's social media was now here, in front of my eyes, and there for the touching. My journey to get here had methodically closed all the tabs on the browser of my imagination, and now I was standing in front of my own home screen. Real life. Shit. Was I really going to do this? I swallowed, pressed my hand on the scarred, mossy wood around the lettering. Hell yes, I was. One step at a time. And setting my shoulders, I pushed myself up into the deep green tree cover towards my first white blaze. I was worried I'd catch up with someone, or that someone would catch up with me. I didn't feel ready for small talk or politeness, or for the pressure that my overtaking someone would put on me to maintain a steady, faster pace. But, confusingly, also not the embarrassment of someone else overtaking me. Already my stupid, busy brain was worrying about all these things at once, instructing me to speed up, slow down, and maintain my current pace all at the same time. If this hike achieved anything, I hope it might slow down this slave driver in my skull a touch. I mean, it's great to be able to see all the angles, but not when you then decide you have to worry about or try to control them all at once. Luckily, though, it took me a long time to see anyone, and I very quickly didn't give a toss about it anyway, because the meandering green path soon turned into a slippy, boulder-riven shitshow. In small 5-minute segments, it would have been ace. A little adventurous section filled with rocks and tree roots to squeeze up and through between smooth paths on a little incline, but it was not that. It was all hard. I had kind of been fooling myself when I read the warning in the books and on the signs. Oh yes, I know it's tough, but I'm going to be one of those people who can just do it. What a dick. 41 years old, years of chronic pain, body issues up the wazoo, and heaving plenty of extra trunk around with me. I'd always had to pretend I could do it, because my pain was invisible and I didn't have a glaringly obvious reason to duck out of anything without a laborious explanation, which, quite frankly, I was fucking over giving out to people. It was also super traumatic. Imagine having to explain the background of your mental health trauma every time someone asked why you were feeling a bit anxious. But for invisible illness sufferers, there seems to be some expectation to justify. I didn't want to anymore. I just wanted to be in the chorus with the rest, not front and centre explaining why I wasn't like everybody else. It's part of the issue with invisible illness that often its sufferers are able to function. The general consensus seems to be that if you're able to do stuff, then you're clearly not actually that ill. It's such an unhealthy way to structure our narrative around being unwell, and we do our society a disservice by needing to see wounds in order to confer compassion. Things seem to be improving, but the rate is slow, and people are silently suffering more than they need to. You see, the dichotomy is that if you're in pain, fatigued or otherwise suffering inside your body, then chances are you're also very likely to be facing some mental health issues. The body, in my opinion and experience, is a whole, not separate pieces that need to be treated as individual elements. Everything we have is joined to something else in the whole, therefore any issue is connected. So it is with our body and our mind. Should you, therefore, have some physical ailment that is not immediately recognisable or visible, and the concurrent depression or anxiety that can go with it, then you probably would like to be doing something nice to take your mind off it. This, however, could become an extremely risky enterprise for your social standing, workplace trust, and relationships with your community. If you had a broken leg, then your community would be able to see that you can't walk well, or run, or swim, or do Zumba. And if they saw you out having a coffee with a friend who had driven you to the cafe and helped you to your seat with crutches, they wouldn't judge you as being a liar or a fraud who was looking for sympathy or skiving work. On the contrary, they would probably applaud you for making the best of your injury and keeping your spirits up. They might even be impressed at your pain management or resilience. If, though, like me, you were in chronic pain that is entirely invisible and went for the same coffee with a friend, you might find the responses to your being there to be quite different. Thought you weren't feeling well? All fixed? Glad to see that. Oh, hey, you're out and about. Why didn't you come to my birthday dinner a couple of nights ago? I was so sad you couldn't make it. We had such a good time dancing. You missed so much fun. And so on and so forth. You can't be seen to be upbeat, like you might be with a broken bone. I have a pretty ebullient personality, so that even when the chips are extremely far down, I can still raise a smile and laugh about it. My way of coping. But it doesn't seem appropriate to use these coping mechanisms when you have an invisible illness, as it apparently comes across that you're taking the piss by trying to be upbeat when you're supposed to be unwell. So here we come to the very frustrating core of this situation. Not only are you suffering, but this is compounded by some societal need to keep yourself humbly isolated, in keeping with traditional ideas of suffering through illness. You're to keep some serious gravitas around it all, playing down the smiles and attempts at joy. Well, sorry, but the word chronic should help you understand that the illness isn't going away, so the expectation to conform to how people behave with acute illnesses isn't going to cut it for us chronics, unless you want us to truly give up on the quality of life we can get in order to fit what you think looks right for an ill person. I had been invisibly unwell, but I certainly became visible on my journey back to wellness. From gentle strength training to learning deadlifts and eventually participating in trail running events that had previously seemed forever out of my reach, I was making a noise because it was better than the deathly silence of suffering. After finding a solution to my chronic condition in Italy, the journey to wellness took years. It was my side project that travelled with me as teaching and tutoring work took me through Alps, valleys, across Hong Kong, Bali and beyond. I built my fitness slowly and couldn't do it alone. I knew of a friendly and knowledgeable team of outdoor trainers at home in Falmouth called Fitness Wild, so I called them from my kitchen in Italy, feeling excited that I might now be able to exercise without pain. After I explained my history and background to them, Ben and Jimmy assured me that they could help, and worked with me both in person and remotely to build not just my body but also my confidence. We inched forwards, even taking steps back to relearn movement and techniques. I started at the beginning and embraced the humility of being at the bottom rung again, diligently doing the work to rebuild myself, from small exertions to big lifts and longer distances. I was laser focused with one goal in mind, to live the lost years with all my might. Which is how I ended up right here, huffing and puffing through the trees with my fresh rosy cheeks and eyes wide with awe, fear and wonder. I was going to struggle, but I was going to fucking do it anyway. It was clear, though, that I wasn't going to struggle as much as Kelly. Kelly was firmly on the struggle bus when I caught up to her, lolling on a rock in the sun and exclaiming good-naturedly that it was super damn hot and she was knackered and thirsty. I agreed. She glugged some water and we took photos of each other and chatted briefly before I asked if she needed anything and carried on past her into the next section. The silence was already interesting to me. I'd been craving silence for so long and now it was all around. The atmosphere seemed dead, and gradually my ears tuned in and the swell of the natural world rose to fill it. The trickling and dripping of snow melt, pine needles dropping, rocks and pebbles shifting, and the deep, ragged breaths that were coming out of me. I stopped regularly, wondering how far the final summit was and being totally unable to work the Guthook Guides app I'd downloaded. That could come later. At this stage, I figured, yeah, it's tough, but it's not super tough, and I don't know why people were saying it's such a difficult way to begin the trail. Soon, though, the path gave way to more boulders and my angle of ascent changed from leaning forwards to scrambling on all fours. It was clear that if this were a platform game on an old Nintendo, I had just cleared the basic level and had now ascended into a different league. I was left wondering what the big boss at the end would be like. About an hour later, I was clinging to the side of a huge rock on a piece of rebar, iron, with my feet inching around the bottom ledge and my butt swinging in the wind. I felt the cold draft that chased up the side of the mountain lifting my top and whistling around my bra as my cheek grazed along the stone. I thought, good God, how the hell is this allowed? What about health and safety? Surely only proper climbers can come up here. What about a top rope and a harness? This isn't okay. I must have taken the wrong route. I stopped and tried to sucker my whole body to the surface for a moment and catch my breath. This time shallow from anxiety and not from exertion. As I did so, I heard a scuffling and a pair of sneakers materialised above me. Someone was coming down. Hey, you doing okay? He asked, as he nimbly shimmied past me. A tall and rangy man in red shorts and a slight tee, a tiny bag with water slung on the side, looking quite at home in this mountain goat territory. Yes, yes, sure am, I smiled at him with a rictus grin and wide eyes. How much farther is it? Oh, not far, he smiled. I would soon come to know that these descent folk measurements of distance are a total fucking lie. But I was still fresh and green at this point. Well, not far until the end of this field. Then there's a sharp ridge like a knife edge for a while. And then, hoo-hoo, then there's a steep bit. And after that, the tablelands. Then the summit. So all in all, another few hours? Not far at all. He beamed at me, totally sweatless and fresh, and I was consumed with the urge to shove him off the side. Another few hours? He had to be fucking kidding. I'd been at it a few hours. This was a joke. Okay, thanks, I chirped, and waited until he had gone before telling myself to buck up. Detaching from my perch, up I went. Over and around more boulders. The tender insides of my upper arms were scratched and grazed from reaching up and dragging myself onto ledges, with my feet precariously balanced on different edges and ledges to stop me from slipping between ice age cracks. Spread-eagled, the knife edge was no joke. I kept my body low from the wind in case a gust cast me off like a finger flick from the gods, further bruising and scraping my shins. Finally, I made it up the acute angle of ascent with a heave and a huff, pulling myself onto a flat plain. I paused and lifted my head, now fully understanding the gut punch of a false summit. You think you're aiming for the top, and even though you're knackered, the very sight of it is encouraging. So you exert every ounce of energy to get there, knowing that it's the end. But it's not the end. It was just the end of a section that blocked the view of the next section. So now I faced a long, flat piece of trail called the Tablelands, and a further ascent in the distance. I was tired and discouraged by this point, but people were close and I didn't want to look like the useless, pain-addled woman that I was trying to shed. So I pulled myself together and set off again. I realised that the people I saw around me were actually working. I was to learn they were trail crew, and I would meet many of them along my route. However, these were the first, gently placing pegs and twine around areas of alpine greenery that had already suffered from the snowmelt and then the footfall of eager hikers keen to get started. I nodded, and they reciprocated as I moved through them. My feet began to hurt from the small sharp rocks through my zero-drop thin-soled shoes. Bile rose, and I felt dizzy and seasick from constantly needing to look down, but simultaneously ahead to judge where to place my feet on the desperately uneven terrain. One false move at any kind of pace, and I'd be done for before I began. I turned to look over my shoulder. No sign of Kelly. No sign of anyone I recognised, actually. In the swivel, I realised what the views around me were like. The true definition of epic. Miles of green in all directions, without even the hint of a conurbation. Trees and more trees, punctuated only by the silvery slashes of lakes and rivers in the afternoon sunlight. Such space. Such peace. Such a big job. It made me well up. As I approached the summit, I could see more people than I expected, sitting around and admiring the views, eating snacks and chatting. In the middle of them stood the iconic Katahdin wooden sign, which I was super keen to drape myself over in relief. More folk approached from ahead of me, which gave me pause and a momentary panic that I'd screwed up, but they'd summited from a different route, the real knife edge. I glanced over at it. "Phew," I said to no one. "Fuck that." "Hey guys," I approached a friendly-looking group of three men who were hovering near the summit sign, that iconic sign I'd been staring at online for the past 12 months. "Would you mind taking some photos of me on the sign?" They all turned and smiled, looking at my day pack and figuring me as a day hiker. I wasn't to know this yet, but there exists a definite divide between day hikers and through hikers. Not an unkind one, but some element of comfort versus arduous privation that would become much clearer once I was more blooded by the forest and coated in weeks of filth. I would pass sweet-smelling day hikers and turn like a zombie to inhale the fragrance of a daily shower and laundered clothes. Like a dog smelling a treat 500 feet away, through hikers could smell day hikers round corners. "Sure we can," and the biggest guy put down his sandwich on a rock and ambled over towards me. I have visited the USA many times, and every time the common thread is kindness and a willingness to help. Sure, a woman with nails at a check-in desk in Miami Airport was once a belligerent witch who made me miss my flight even though I was there 3 hours early, but aside from that, and the occasional barging for the metro, everyone had been angels to me. Little did I know that the angeling had just begun. This trail was full of them. The day hiker fellas and I enjoyed the usual chat about where I was from. "England, wow, what brings you out here? Whoa, a through hiker, neat, what's that flag?" And then they ambled back to their lunch and left me examining the sign. With my Cornish St. Piran's flag gripped in my left hand, I placed my right onto the scarred wood. So many people were on their way north right now, striving through woods and over mountains to end their hike at this very sign, and I was just beginning. It almost didn't feel right to have had my photo taken with it, having done less than one day, but I knew I'd be earning the moment in the days to come. Balancing my feet on sharp rock edges, I moved around to the back of the sign, hand over hand on the wood until I could climb up the wooden struts on the reverse. Clambering as high as I could, I swept my vision left and right. Breathtaking space, sharp air like wasabi in my nostrils, unbelievable amounts of pure nature, with no cities or towns anywhere. I'd be in there tomorrow, deep and irreversibly in the green. With Kate. What could possibly go wrong? I brewed up a quick cup of coffee and broke into some oatmeal packets while I pondered. The way down was hard, and I was more fatigued than I had realised. Getting to the end of the tablelands was okay. Going past Thoreau Spring, named for the great naturalist Henry David Thoreau, who ascended Katahdin in 1846 as part of his quest for a life deliberately lived, and who wrote The Maine Woods, capturing the wilder side of America in his forest excursions. Much, of course, as I was planning to do if I could reverse my big ass back down the steep scrambles in my current giddy vertigo whirl. I repeatedly peeped through my arms down to where my feet should land, trying to make sure that I wasn't going to catch just a toe tip and then lean my weight on nothing but dust and gravel, careening down the side of a sheer drop. My fingertips were raw from gripping the rock edges over my head. I gingerly lowered myself down each rock, the flimsy brim of my cap catching on the edges, pushing it back over my head. Every time it happened, I absent-mindedly risked death by letting go with one hand and grabbing the cap to force it back on, but then panicked and flailed to grip the rock again. What an ignoble way to go. Maybe I wasn't cut out for this. I didn't even like the bloody hat. The wind had picked up and brought voices to my ears from far below, then whipped them away and gave me only static. I continued steadily down. It wasn't long after I descended into the green forested section of the lower mountain that I glimpsed someone ahead. The back of a pale shirt between branches, then gone again down a lower switchback or behind a set of huge monolithic rocks. Incrementally, I caught the cipher up, very happy to see another face once I had realised from his gait and frame that it was Lee. I was surprised to have caught up with him. He was so fast in the morning, disappearing like the bullet from a gun, and I had surmised that he was an extremely experienced hiker. He didn't have his full green pack with him, so was without his hatchet, but his day pack still looked full and weighty, with lumps and bumps protruding. If I wasn't such a novice, I might have thought that it even looked a little poorly packed. "Hey, Lee!" I shouted, my words absorbed immediately by greenery, branches and earth. He didn't hear, and I speeded up, kicking brown pine needles and hanging on to tree trunks as I swung around path corners to move faster. "Lee! Yo! Hold up, buddy!" He turned quickly, putting his further away hand out to brace against a boulder and slow his pace. He saw me and his face lit up into a relieved smile. "Hey, Gail, oh, how are you? This was hard, right? It was steep. I'm really tired. Taking it slower coming down. Are you okay? How'd you find it?" He spoke softly but quickly, his words tumbling gently out. It was clear he'd found the day harder than he expected. "I'm good. Yes, it was really hard. Your pack looks super heavy, though. What do you have in there?" He shrugged. I clearly wasn't getting pack secrets from Lee just yet. "Nothing much." He paused. "You want to walk together?" Yes. Yes, I did. For all my craving of solitude and silence, I now really wanted to be in someone's company. The woods section was short, but I was still uneasy with the lack of peripheral vision it gave me, like being in murky seawater far from shore. You know nothing is probably in there, but you can't see clearly enough to be sure. My hunter-gatherer hindbrain was probably propping itself up out of bed on one elbow and trying to gather its wits about what danger there might be after snoozing for countless years while I sat indoors doing jobs on computers or safely in steel and stone buildings. I think its default setting before it fully woke was to press danger until it could get something more nuanced together after a coffee. So yes, company felt good. Lee was an interesting character. He spoke at length about politics, technology, data collection, and topics as diverse as astrophysics, consciousness, and weapon sales. I hadn't expected my brain to be quite so stimulated at the same time as my body, creating a jerky gait as I thought for a moment and stumbled, or walked fast and nimbly but sounded dumb. Eventually, I just let Lee talk, humming and umming to chivvy him along. I knew he and Kate would hit it off, with their physicsy mathsy brains, and was keen to get them together. We stopped at a waterfall and river that I'd barely noticed on my way up, excited as I was to get going. Our thirst was raging, and we both carefully lowered ourselves down the slippery mud banks on either side of the wooden planked bridge over the torrent. One hand gripped a flimsy branch, and the other waved my silicone water pouch in the river, trying to get the mouth to open up without my being able to finger it open. My right foot slipped backwards in the gunk, and I landed on one knee with a heavy oof. Oh well. I was in it now and sat in the mud, prizing the water container open with both hands, watching with tired satisfaction as it swelled immediately. As I screwed the water filter onto the nozzle and secured the bag, I heard my name over the torrent of water. Kate had arrived. Chatting happily about her day and mine, we descended towards the campgrounds and I collected my pack. Somewhere along the way, we lost Lee, gathered an armful of firewood from the ranger station, and found our shelter for the night. A three-sided structure built with logs, a slightly pitched roof, and an open sleeping platform set back inside, which stretched about 3 metres wide, the wooden planks faded, but mostly clean. Along the front edge of the shelter there was a gap, and then a long log fixed as a seat. I guess you could sit on the edge of the sleeping platform with your legs dangling in the gap if it was raining, or sit out on the log if it was fine. It also gave some room to unpack and then hang your bag if the weather was torrential instead of doing it outside the shelter and making all your dry stuff wet. No one wants to do the wet unpacking when the shelter's full of other people. Not good etiquette. Speaking of good trail etiquette, Kate and I didn't know shit. So we put our tents up inside the wooden shelter, without the fly, of course, so that we felt safer sleeping. I mean, this was lunacy, but we couldn't quite get our heads around the fact that if we just lay there in our sleeping bags, then the armies of black flies and mosquitoes would just eat our bare faces. We were also still in that transition period of feeling secure behind walls and a little vulnerable sleeping in the woods without them. Mix some bears into the equation with novice Brits and you get tents inside a shelter. I gazed at the tents and felt that this definitely wasn't the adventurous image I'd seen for myself. The tent frames didn't quite fit and pinged their feet out over the lip, causing the tents to lose tension and sag one after the other, despite repeated fixing. Fuck it. I was too tired to care. Fire lit, we drank a celebratory beer that Kate had brought with her. She drew deeply from the can and fixed her eyes on me. "How did Kelly get on?" she asked. She and Kelly were of similar fitness, and Kate had been worried about her own ability to get up and down Katahdin in a timely fashion, so had some concerns for our new friend. "I saw her on the way up," I thought for a moment, and then felt a little guilty. "But weirdly, I didn't see her coming back. I thought maybe she'd stopped at a lookout for a snack or something. Didn't ask Lee if he'd seen her either, actually." I paused. Kate was quiet too. I thought about how thirsty I had been on the way back, how tired I had been, and the dusk creeping into the trees even though the sun was far from fully dipping. I remembered that Kelly hadn't taken her water filter, thinking it was a bit unnecessary. I furrowed my brow, trying to recall how much water she'd shoved in her bag before disappearing up the path that morning. "Not much," I thought. "She'll be fine, won't she?" I really wasn't sure. How does it work out here when you're on your own, but you're not really on your own? Who assumes responsibility for wondering where you are? And how do you worry about someone when we're all out here being wild, free and strong, so you don't risk looking like a clucky mother hen? It was slowly dawning on me that this hike was going to be a navigation of more than just woods. We could go and check the register, I guess. Let's go. We jumped off the shelter ledge and walked back to the trailhead in the cooling early summer evening. It was still light enough to see. People in pockets of woodland were setting up fires and talking in hushed tones. Peals of laughter reached us and made me momentarily grieve for being alone and that forcible need to go and make new friends that solo travel gives you. But I knew that it would all come soon enough. For now, Kate and I were a team, and we needed to find Kelly. "Ha ha ha, yeah, I just totally didn't bring enough water. He was just so great helping me out like that." Kelly was safe and well, reminiscing about the dream boat we only knew from her as Kit, but who we would later know as Baby Milkshakes. Her Katahdin tale involved heroes, Kit, villains, the mountain, and an unreasonably hot and hard hike. It was a gripping yarn. But later, as Milkshakes and I crossed paths and hiked together through Virginia, the story would flesh out to include stopping her from drinking from a filthy puddle without a filter and helping her through rocks in a delirium to ensure she got down okay. Kelly was a card all right, but sadly, we weren't to have her on trail for long. He was like, so hot. Do we really have to move again now? She sat fisting in peanut M&Ms from her gargantuan bag of trail mix. We'd been sitting a while already, and I was feeling frustrated with all of the stopping and starting. I think we need to move now to get to the campsite before dark. I glanced at Kate for confirmation, and she nodded. We were on day 3 and moving slowly. Lee had also already had a nightmarish couple of days, and we were well updated on his misery. A tent that wasn't waterproof that he'd bought second-hand. Holes in the netting too large to deter the swarms of mozzies we were up against. And that, shock, horror, tins and jars of supplies might actually turn out to be too heavy to carry for 10 days. We had found him that morning with wet kit, a soaked pack and a useless tent. I just kept going into the night and found an old boat which I'd crawled under in the rainstorm, he said. An old boat? What the hell? We're in the middle of nowhere. I don't think it was on trail, he mumbled. Your face, Lee! Do you want some antihistamines? I started to pull my pack off. No, it's okay. He lifted his shirt, and there were at least 30 more angry welts across his chest. I took off my wet clothes to sleep under the boat, and then the ants got me, as well as the mosquitoes. I had never seen anyone more miserable, so I pressed the tablets into his hand with some anti-Hizan cream and shook my head. Take it all. I have too much stuff anyway, I said, walking away so he couldn't refuse. I left him smearing on cream and hefting his huge pack over his shoulders. Lee, great to know but tough to be. He was determined to make the hike harder than it already was, and it was already pretty taxing. The next evening I got to camp behind him, only to hear his screams and rants through the deep thickets down by the river. Pure pain and irritation, loud fury and disbelief. He couldn't seem to hear my yells to see if he was okay, and so I marched down the Blue Blaze Trail to the river to see if I could see him. There he was, across the river, scratched and defeated, filling up a bottle. He still couldn't hear or see me, so I filled mine and made it back to camp long before he emerged. He looked at my bottles and then at me. What's that? Water. Where the heck? He said, his face scratched and wild. I pointed meekly to the blue blazes. His shoulders sagged. I didn't get far enough in to see that. Oh! I just wanted water so bad, so I went through there. I could hear it. He gestured to the thick bush, arms scratched and bleeding on top of his bug bites. With enormous defeat, he grabbed the top of his heavy green pack and dragged it towards the shelter ledge. His axe fell out of the side onto the dirt. I'm so tired, he mumbled. My pack's so heavy, I can't go as fast as I want, and my knees hurt. I nodded at him, wanting to put my hand on his shoulder or offer some words of support, but we were deep into the 100-mile wilderness with no easy way out. Everything he brought, he was going to have to take out. It wasn't possible to dump food in the woods. Leave no trace was serious, and even cooked food that you buried was enough to disrupt the natural order of things. I didn't want to give him any false hope. Leave No Trace has 7 principles that were made to help people who visit the outdoors to understand how they can leave the least impact. 3 of these principles are to leave what you find as you found it, to dispose of your waste properly and respect wildlife, all things that are disrupted by the dumping of food in the woods behind you, even if it's without packaging and cooked. You might think you're helping feed wildlife, or that it'll biodegrade, but I had learned in my research that it might attract wildlife to humans or pollute a water system. You just don't know, so the best thing to do is, literally, leave no trace that you were there. Lee needed to saddle up and carry all his shit out, which of course he was always happy to do. Well, happy might have been a stretch. It'll be okay, I said. You can push on through. I wanted to laugh so hard at the thought of him screaming fury at the woods, but this was more indicative of my level of hysteria. At least he was honest and out loud. Kate and I were making things hard through our bickering. We were so different. We loved each other and had trodden a long road, but I was the eternal bubbly optimist and she the dour realist. In real life, it was a clash made in heaven, as it served to balance us. But finding that balance out here was proving agonising for us both. 3 days into the 100 mile, and the pressure was building on both of us not to lose our tempers and break down into swearing, and the kind of sobbing that shoots big snot bubbles out of one nostril. Despite my preparation, I was beginning to feel fatigue with the intensity of focus and energy that the trail took. Roots to step between, slick rocks to navigate, and the weight of an over-full pack. I felt for Kate, as we had quickly learned that she was allergic to the pine trees we were surrounded by. Yet still, she kept coming, strong and focused, despite not getting the breaks that I did when I paused for her to catch up. We rested briefly and often, then forged forwards together, finding it hard in the misty light to see where the slippery roots began and ended underfoot. Both of us regularly took knees to the forest gods, filling the air with our thunks and tremendous sighs of resignation as we struggled back up to our feet and pushed on. I felt a lurch in my gut when I realised that Kate was struggling and pushing herself hard. It was to be expected with such a short time to prepare, but she wasn't one to give up, and I knew she didn't want me to worry, so I continued to hike a little ahead and not crowd her. I was so glad she was here, out of character as it was. But I was beginning to suspect that it might have been a little easier to have taken being let down by Richard as a sign to come alone, rather than agree to Kate's suggestion to wingwoman me. I had a feeling she might think the same. I strode forwards at my natural cadence, dodging roots and heaving myself over blowdowns until I got into a rhythm and was trucking along pretty pleasantly. Regularly I'd notice she wasn't anywhere behind me, so I'd stop and wait, terrifying myself by imagining scenarios where I had to tell her husband and children that she'd been lost down a deep crevice on a wild mountainside, and I was sorry I hadn't kept a closer eye on her. Then she'd arrive, and we'd continue. In rain, drizzle, mist and storms, she powered through without stopping. Her cadence may have been slower than mine, but her strength of mind and steady rhythm meant that she would appear in good time. She would stop to reach in her pack for a drink or snack and then plod forwards, urging me to go on ahead and stop waiting because it made her feel bad. So off I'd go, and our pattern would run again. I didn't think about it then, but later, when I joined a crew and was the slowest, I realised how shit it is. No breaks. No rest, using every ounce of energy just to keep up. Then, as soon as you arrive, everyone heads off, finishing their break as you sit down, feeling like the slow, crap hiker, even though you tried so hard. The 100 miles sounds pretty daunting, but isn't as wild as it sounds. In reality, it just has no paved roads or services, but you can get access to trailheads for day hikes if you want to by utilising the dirt gravel logging roads into the interior. However, for us naive and just-been-born hikers, it might well have been the middle of the jungle in the 1800s. Just 2 nights previously, things had been looking okay, but now we felt remote. The number of people we were seeing had thinned out dramatically, and the trees seemed to crowd us when we took our eyes off them, sneaking closer into our peripheral vision like people hiding in tree suits, shuffling up to shout, "Boo!" It was time for some space, and we found it. On night 4, in the wild, we pitched at Antlers, a camp space next to a glorious lake. There was room enough between trees on the flat, dry ground for us to set up away from others who were arriving. The solo hikers who hadn't found buddies or who preferred to be alone dripped steadily into camp until there were almost 10 of us scattered around the lake shore, including a small group of giggly schoolgirls on an outdoor trip with their teacher. They set up in a central obvious spot, but hikers arriving tucked themselves away in naturally screened tent spaces, surrounded by greenery that had been clearly smoothed and flattened by countless tents that had come before. Sweeping away dry pine needles and cones with our hands, we set up shelters and started to cook. Eating was number one on the list. We were famished. After that, it was a couple of fistfuls of sweets and then to the lake itself. Was it worth a dip? I had gone 5 days without a wash and felt grimier than I had ever remembered being. Lakes gave me the creeps for swimming, but this one was right there, glistening and beautiful, and I was feeling extremely in need of ablutions. So in I went in my knickers and sports bra, which I then took off underwater and washed as best I could. I didn't use any suds or chemicals so as not to pollute the water. A good rinse, though, was still going to make a difference, I hoped. I then jumped out so Kate could hop in and I could photograph her escapades in the lake for her children. It was too beautiful not to, and the dusky sunset with the calls of birds and coyotes made us feel humble and happy. I rested alone in my tent later that night, marvelling that I'd got up Katahdin, down again, and was now actually in the 100 mile. My hip hadn't popped out of place, my legs were working okay, and my pain levels were really manageable. Perhaps only a little higher than you'd expect anyone's to be after this quick immersion into physical activity. How had I got away with it? Had my body not caught up with what I was doing yet? Perhaps the pain was going to creep up on me slowly. It had before. In fact, I shouldn't be surprised if it did. My original illness had all started with only a few days of aching that just never went away. In my 20s, I got a twinge in my lower back. I ignored it and didn't go to the doctor. You don't bother the doctor unless your leg has fallen off. Life was fine. I was the stroke rower for my local gig club. I ran distance. I was trying to learn to surf. And I was as fit as a fiddle studying for my PGCE in Exeter. But the twinge wouldn't go away. I didn't moan. I perhaps mentioned it a few times, but I didn't moan. What's a bad back, eh? Every boring bastard has one of those, and those that do just moan about it. I don't want to be like them, I thought. I don't want to be a moaner. My mind occasionally threw me back to my years working at a coastal hotel at home, where one of the handsome young men who worked there in the holidays, like me, was always getting out of hoovering. Just the hoovering. Always moaning that his lower back hurt. I was convinced that he was just lazy, until he had a spinal tumour diagnosed and died a few weeks later in his early 20s. Sometimes I thought about this, but shoved it back down. No space for that in the day-to-day. The pain nagged me until I was struggling to lean over school desks at work and to get my shopping out from the car. I couldn't really row anymore, but the team were counting on me for the Gig World Championships on the Scilly Isles. I was eating ibuprofen and paracetamol like sweets to get through the days, and sometimes the pain would surge enough to make me vomit. But I couldn't give up on these things. The relationship I was in, the running, the rowing and my teaching. My body needed to buck the fuck up and get with the program. This is really where my pain story divides like sliding doors. In one direction is a sprain or a disc bulge that heals, and I return to my normal life. The other is, unbeknownst to me at the time, the dark path into the woods of my life where I can't go backwards, only further in. This is the same for all of us who suffer from something chronic, in our minds or our bodies. Each week of pain, each therapy, each disappointment, each sacrifice closes a door behind you. This is the slow creeping beginning where you don't even realise that your life has started changing. But when you look back, you realise, fuck, it was then. That moment. That was the last time I was my old self. My real self. Chronic illness is like the child catcher. It sneaks in under the radar of an ache or a pain, but puts a bag over your head, slings you in the wagon, and drives you away from yourself. By the time you've realised what's happened, you're abroad from your old life and there's no way to return. It's possible to come back sometimes. I know I did. But your original self is no longer there. It's moved. It's an empty house. And if you want to move back in, you've got to furnish it with all the new luggage you carry. Stuff that's almost impossible to throw out. Maybe this was the place to throw the luggage out. Maybe I could walk along this trail if my body let me, shedding bags and bags of the pain of the past as I moved through it, and go back to my old self, a kind of leave no trace, but of my trauma, not of my physical presence. Maybe by the time I reached the end, I'd summit Springer Mountain as a tabula rasa, scoured and empty of all the old baggage. Wouldn't that be nice? I thought, rolling onto my other side, my thermarest crinkling like a multi-pack of crisps as I did so. I smiled at the idea of being scrubbed clean and luggageless, and fell asleep on the honest earth, listening to the crickets with a heart full of hope. Rain was set to come in over the next few days, and I had been asking my Garmin InReach for weather updates sporadically. I wasn't looking forward to getting drenched, but I knew it was coming, and I also knew Kate wasn't going to like it much. I'd wondered how quickly I was going to be learning lessons about myself out here, and the answer was clearly pretty goddamn fast. I now realised that my positive nature wasn't just how I was, but something I had unconsciously cultivated to get me through all the shit I'd experienced. It wasn't a choice, but a need, and Kate's need to be scientific and deliberately realistic was pissing me off. "Don't worry, Kate," I said on day 5. We were both careening towards broken, tired, bitten, and in pieces. Exhaustion was making us both drag our feet. We weren't strong enough to lift them up and over rocks, and we were swearing constantly as our shins ground into sharp edges. We had both fallen more times than we could count. I would try to keep spirits up. "Don't worry," I would repeat ad infinitum. "I think we'll get into camp before dark tonight." Big smile, even though I didn't feel it. "I can light a fire and make you dinner. I could go and get water. It'll be early enough for eating in the light and setting up easily." I arranged my face and set about getting behind my own optimism. She would grimace and reply along these lines. "By my calculation, at the rate we're hiking and the terrain we're covering currently, we will take another 4.5 hours to get to camp, Gale. Then part of the next route on the paper map shows we are going uphill more, slowing us further. That'll put us an hour after dark, and the water source at the next camp is another 0.3 miles down a steep track, in the dark. It will probably rain, based on the forecast, and so we'll be arriving wet and in the dark. Let's be realistic." Oh, for fuck's sake. I don't want to be fucking realistic, Kate. I want to be a bit fucking positive. I want to imagine that it might all be okay, or I won't get through the next 3 fucking hours before it even gets dark. I threw a pole on the ground, clearly crosser than I'd realised. Why can't we have a bit of cheer? Why can't we pretend it's going to be great and ease up? I frowned my dirtiest frown at her, useless in the face of her obstinacy. I was just as annoying to her in my Tiggeresque, idiotic hopefulness as she was to me in her hyperlogical realism. We were escalating in moments like this, sparking off the old relationship from school and moving to our established positions, the ones that didn't work out well for me back then. But now things were a little different. I was more able to find resilience and not back down. I didn't like how it felt, but in this situation, I was probably being unkinder to her than she was to me. Perhaps fair enough in the grand scales of our lives, but not someone I was comfortable being. My patience was becoming short, my excitement to dig into my epic journey nipping at my heels. I didn't want to be brought into a negative mindset about the whole trail by my friend who got to go home in just under a week. I had to try and keep my idiotic optimism going, or I wouldn't ever make the distance. I needed to find a way to make it work for both of us, or we were going to hit the skids. That's how I felt anyway, and we weren't even halfway through the 100 mile. Christ, I needed to get a grip. Chapter 5. No Shining Armour. I winced, my shin scraping the sharp corner of the jagged rock step for the second time that minute, my usual painkillers not touching the raw, immediate injuries my body was sustaining through each day. I was getting angry thinking about it. Why was I going backwards? Why was I here in the dark and rain, 70 miles into the 100-mile wilderness, an ascending elevation that I had already completed and descended an hour before? I tripped, falling sharply forwards but saving myself, braced on slick, cold rock. I'd done this, Whitecap Mountain, the highest in the 100 mile, hours ago. At the top, I'd sat watching storm clouds gather as the incredible views of Maine and endless pine forests were gobbled up by mist and the incoming evening. Earlier that day, I'd reached Logan Brook Shelter and scooted my butt onto the wooden base of the three-sided hut. Only one other person was inside, and I gave him a smiley, "Hey!" I was still in the phase of enjoying the double take I'd get when folks heard my British accent. "Hey," he replied coolly. I vaguely recognised him and asked if we'd met before somewhere in the past few days. The only people we passed were usually going north doing a section hike. It was too early in the season for northbound thru-hikers to have made it up here yet. "Yeah," he said. "You and your friend helped me out when I got turned around up there by Potawatomi." Fuck. I remembered now. Oh man, this poor guy. I had first passed him going north when I was on my way to stop for the night at the Potawatomi lean-to. He had hustled past me with purpose, about 40 minutes out from the shelter, going down trail as we were going up. Just a nod and a hello, that's all. A little while later, this was just after Lee's water fiasco, when he was settled into the shelter for the night and Kate and I had set up our tents by the big pines, we were all sitting with our butts along the edge of the shelter lip, eating our food and listening to our muscles groaning as they unwound from the day. It was then that we heard a rustle. Out from behind the shelter, from a direction we hadn't yet explored, came a man in the dusky evening. "Hi," he mumbled. "Can y'all tell me the way to leave the camp southbound?" Hatchet, who was really Lee with his new trail name,